A History of Ancient Sparta, Lecture 12. Earthquake, Revolt, Storm Clouds Gathering. The Peloponnesian War to the Peace of Nicias.
In the early years of the Peloponnesian War, not much that was very decisive happened. Ordinarily, Sparta would invade Attica every summer in campaigning season, stay for several weeks, six or so, basically the maximum, and do whatever damage they could to Athenian crops, Athenian olive trees. Olive trees, in fact, are very difficult to damage fatally, and would then depart. The Spartan hope was that the destruction of crops would put the pinch on Athens so that they would negotiate a favorable settlement. But because Athens was a sea power, and because, moreover, Athens was walled and had built the so-called long walls to the Athenian ports at Phaleron and Piraeus, they were pretty much invulnerable to attack by land. The Spartans very much hoped to persuade the Athenians to come out and engage them in an infantry battle. But the Athenians, knowing that the Spartans were considerably better soldiers than they were, didn't take the bait and stayed behind their walls and relied on their ships, and meanwhile contented themselves with causing as much trouble as they could for Sparta with naval raids all along the Peloponnesian coast. So each side was playing to its strengths, and the only really decisive thing that happened was, for understandable reasons, the plague in Athens in the first years of the war. Plague in a besieged city, which Athens in effect was, is of course commonplace and a predictable result of great overcrowding and poor sanitation. Under such conditions, typhus and dysentery are commonplace and have been throughout military history. The plague in Athens seems, at least to most observers, to have been something more severe than that, and it is very memorably described by Thucydides. But even the plague was not enough to persuade the Athenians to negotiate, and the war continued, as Pericles had foreseen that it would have, though he died early on as well, in a kind of stalemate. The Athenian naval power could not force the Spartans into an untenable position, but likewise, Spartan land power could not force the Athenians into an untenable position. And so things essentially remained until the mid-420s, when, as part of naval operations in waters to the west of Greece proper, kind of originally as an afterthought, the Athenian commander Demosthenes landed at Pylos, the old home of Nestor, in what is now in Messenia, and unloaded a detachment there with a view in part towards fomenting dissent and rebellion among the Messenian Helots, whom the Athenians knew very well, were a discontented population. The Spartans countered, called off their invasion of Attica, and tried to respond to the Athenians in and around Pylos. And eventually, in a little island off the shore of Pylos, about half a mile off, maybe 400 yards from shore at its narrowest point, something like that. A mountainous island. It's always called the Little Island. I've, in fact, been there, and it's a couple miles long and maybe half a mile wide, something like that. It's pretty substantial. But nonetheless, the Spartan force found themselves boxed on the island of Sphacteria, as it's called, and the Athenians had naval hegemony in the local waters, and so supplying the Spartans on the island of Sphacteria was really difficult. They couldn't get off, even though it's not terribly far. The Spartans were reduced to offering to Helots the reward of freedom if they would risk being caught by the Athenian naval forces and take supplies across, either by swimming or in small boats. And some did. And for a while, things continued at Sphacteria as a sort of stalemate. At this point, one of Thucydides' bête noire, perhaps his least favorite Athenian political figure of all time, a man by the name of Cleon, was complaining about the poor progress that the Athenians were making in their activities in Messenia and at Sphacteria, and was more or less taunted, saying, if you think you can do better, why don't you do it? And he was driven into accepting that command, and in fact succeeded in, to the astonishment of the Greek world, setting fire to the island and making use largely of archers, forcing the surrender of 400 Spartan troops, including 120 homoioi, or full Spartans. This was shocking. Thermopylae was still, though distantly, within living memory, and if there was one thing that everybody knew about the Spartans, it was that they never surrendered and fought to the death instead. The surrender of the Spartans on Sphacteria was a huge blow to Spartan morale, and also effectively put an end to Spartan offensive operations, because the prisoners were taken to Athens, and any offensive Spartan operation was countered with the threat that the homoioi in Athens would be executed. That really slowed things down until finally, in 422-21, the Athenians and Spartans negotiated a sort of peace, largely at the instigation of an Athenian politician called Nicias, known as the Peace, unsurprisingly, of Nicias. Meanwhile, though, stymied more or less in their usual activities, invading Attica was a dangerous proposition with the Spartan prisoners there, the Spartans, in effect, opened a new front under the impetus of one of the most appealing of all of the Spartan figures who come to us in the record, a man by the name of Brasidas, who had been, in fact, an ephor as a relatively young man at the very beginning of the Peloponnesian War, but with a new sort of troops, and this is the first time we hear of such troops, he undertook operations in the north of Greece, where the Athenians had established colonies, and also where he could directly or indirectly threatened the Athenian grain supply. The forces that he took with him were, in a very few instances, full Spartans, but for the most part, troops who the Spartans referred to as neodamodois, which is to say new citizens or new quasi-citizens or new members of the people or something like that. What they were, in fact, were freed helots who were freed on condition that they would serve in the Spartan army. And under Brasidas, they served very, very well. He marched them from Sparta all the way up through Megara, through Thessaly to Macedonia and Thrace in the north of Greece, and there began operations which proved very successful against the Athenian colonies there. Not only was he a superb military commander, for my money about as good as Sparta ever produced, he was also, as Thucydides puts it, a noble fellow and a very persuasive speaker for a Spartan. So some Athenian colonies defected to Spartan leadership under Brasidas voluntarily, just because of his persuasive powers. And one, indeed, the Athenian city of Amphipolis finally thought so much of him that they honored him as a god and as their founder, even though they had actually been founded by Athens after Brasidas' death. Amphipolis, however, during this period was a real bone of contention. Cleon, continuing his new military career, was dispatched to try to take care of Brasidas in Thrace, and attempting to take Amphipolis from the Spartans, Cleon was killed, but unfortunately, Brasidas was killed as well, and the Peace of Nicias ensued. The fact that there was a peace declared between Sparta and Athens at this point does not mean that there was no hostility between Sparta and Athens, return of the captives from Sphacteria or no. And in particular, Alcibiades, a brilliant young man who had been raised as the ward of Pericles and was one of the Alcmaeonids, like Cleisthenes before, who had always been suspicious of Sparta, began to undertake political machinations trying to bring about an alliance of sorts between Argos, Sparta's traditional enemy, Elis, home of Olympia, one of Sparta's traditional allies, Mantinea in central Arcadia, all cities in the Peloponnese, and hence a real threat to Sparta, and also Athens. And in 418, indeed, these operations prompted a battle which was not, technically speaking, part of the Peloponnesian War, but did involve conflict between the predominantly Argive alliance, which included Athens, and Sparta at the city of Mantinea. And this was one of the largest infantry battles ever fought in Greece. As a matter of fact, the Spartans lined up on one side, just a second here, one thing, under the leadership of King Agis, with Brasidas Neodamodois Skiritae, light troops on the right wing, the Spartans more or less in the center, the Spartan allies, the Tegeans and assorted other Arcadians on the right, facing opposite them, Mantineans, Arcadians, Argives, others, and Athenians in a battle line. After considerable jockeying, the Mantineans and Arcadians on the Argive-Athenian right started to put to flight Brasidas's Neodamodois and the Scyrtai. Meanwhile, the Spartans and the Tegeans, however, or Tegeans, began to push back from the Spartan right wing against the Allied left. And in the end, Sparta proved victorious, Spartan discipline triumphing again, and indeed so strikingly that the consensus judgment at the time was that Sparta had, in effect, won back at least most of the prestige which had been lost 7 years before at Sphacteria. Alcibiades, however, was by no means done with making trouble, and he was instrumental in persuading in 416-15 the Athenians that what they should do is undertake an invasion of Sicily, and in particular, an invasion, an attempted conquest of Syracuse. This was a huge project. Syracuse was a city not only more or less of the size and wealth of Athens, but also a fellow democracy. There was no conceivable ideological reason at this point for the Athenians to be involved. This was something more or less like a pure power play, and indeed Alcibiades and others seem to have thought that if things went well, Athens could go on and begin operations in the rest of Sicily and Italy and Carthage and so on, and fashion for themselves something not unlike a world empire. The problem was, though they were not technically at war with Sparta, they were still very much in a hostile relationship with Sparta, and committing so heavily to this sort of operation had the potential to make the Athenians astonishingly vulnerable. All the more so since once the expeditionary force departed, Alcibiades, one of its leaders, was called home on charges of impiety and sacrilege. His enemies had waited to bring the charges until the army had departed, because they figured that the army would support Alcibiades and prevent his conviction. But once the army was gone, they figured if they could get Alcibiades back, they could execute him and bring about, obviously, thereby his death. Well, Alcibiades knew this as well as his Athenian enemies knew it, and rather than tamely coming home, he turned traitor to Athens and defected to Sparta, where he went more Spartan than the Spartans, which surprised everyone because he was a golden boy and notorious high liver and Olympic victor and certainly not famous for anything like Spartan self-control, though famous for eloquence, brilliance, and military skills, most assuredly. He began to out-Spartan the Spartans, impressed them, and argued to them that since he had made, in large part, the plans of Athens, Sparta could wish for no better advisor on how to defeat the plans of Athens. In particular, he made two recommendations. One, that the Spartans send a general to lead the defenses of Syracuse, which the Spartans did, sending the Mothax, or honorary, or half-Spartan Gylippus to take over. And two, with Sphacteria in mind as a locus for disaffection among Sparta's subservient helots, he suggested that the Spartans might want to capture a place within Athenian territory to foment discord among the Athenians and as a refuge for Athenian slaves. The Spartans did so, occupied Decelea, which for the remainder of the war served precisely the function that Alcibiades had envisioned as a focus for discontent and unrest in the Attican homeland, and Gylippus finally triumphed so thoroughly in Sicily that virtually the entire expeditionary force of many tens of thousands, which Athens could ill spare, and the entire Athenian fleet was effectively, by 413, destroyed. Well, at this point, Athens found itself, after having been on top in negotiating the Peace of Nicias, in real trouble. And all the more so when from 412 on, the Spartans were able to formulate at least a half-hearted alliance with Tissaphernes, one of the local satraps or regional rulers or governors in Persia. Athens at this point was very close to losing the war, very close to losing control of the Hellespont, which would mean losing control of the war. But then, after having departed from Sparta under a cloud because of his purported affair with the Spartan king's wife, among other instances of dubious behavior, an affair that came to light during a small earthquake which knocked down the door of the house in which, so report has it, the wife of the Spartan king and Alcibiades were engaged in nocturnal activities of a mutually satisfying kind, and Alcibiades departed in more or less plain sight, his welcome in Sparta having worn rather thin. He took off for friendlier parts. He wasn't welcome in Athens either at this point, so he instead took up with Tissaphernes, the Persian satrap, to whom his advice was, the best thing you can do is try to make sure that Athens and Sparta are more or less equal and are so engaged in fighting each other that they can't cause Persia much trouble. Well, after that, you would be inclined to think that Alcibiades' options were limited. But Athens still had a fleet in being, and a powerful fleet in being, based, for the most part, not in Athens itself, but on the island of Samos. Alcibiades appeared there in another complicated series of events, was welcomed, reassumed command of the Athenian fleet, and astonishingly turned things around. Instrumental in the Athenian victory at the Battle of Cunemessa in 411 and Cyzicus in 410, which had the effect of reopening the Hellespont and putting Athens right back in the forefront of the war. Eventually, however, at the Battle of Notium, yet another battle, he wore out his welcome in Athens for good by departing on a money-raising expedition and leaving not the elected Athenian sub-commanders in charge, but his own helmsman in charge, with orders under no circumstances to engage the Persian fleet, which his helmsman nonetheless did and lost, allowing Alcibiades' enemies, of whom for understandable reasons he had many, to claim that rather than going out and raising money, as he claimed, he was going out in his usual fashion for debauchery, parties, and general immoral high living, and that was the end of Alcibiades as a political force in Athens. Meanwhile, a new commander had been set out for Sparta, another Mothax, a man by the name of Lysander, who, as he was going through the agoge, or upbringing, had been the inspirer or lover of the person who became, ultimately, King Agesilaus II. Lysander was unscrupulous and unpleasant in many respects, but by no means incompetent. And he was helped very, very much in his activities by the fact that a new satrap was sent to the area as a sub-ruler for Persia, the 16-year-old son, younger son, of King Darius II, who was named after his illustrious namesake Cyrus. He and Lysander hit it off famously. And Cyrus contributed vast amounts of money to the Spartan war effort, enabling Lysander, among other things, to hire rowers at a third higher rate than the Athenians were able to do. Throughout Sparta's life as a state, the Spartan navy had been markedly inferior to the navy of Athens. That, at this point, began to change. Lysander was able to hire better rowers. War losses had cut down on the number of highly trained rowers available to Athens, losses in battle and whatnot, and Sparta began, for the first and effectively the last time, to take a brief naval lead as well as a military lead over Athens. Spartan law allowed a person to serve as navarch, or head admiral, only 1 year. And so, at the end of 407, Lysander had to go back to Sparta, and he was replaced by a Spartan in many respects nobler and more attractive than he, but unfortunately somewhat less able. The Spartan fleet was at this point still very, very much superior to the Athenian fleet, and Callicratidas tried, as Lysander had done, to pay court to Cyrus for money, but Cyrus insulted him and kept him waiting. Callicratidas was not Lysander and did not have his oily social skills with superiors, and Callicratidas departed infuriated, supposedly claiming that he would never again participate in taking money for barbarians, and the whole Peloponnesian War was a horrible idea, and in fact, Sparta and Athens should be united rather than fighting each other, and should be fighting Persia rather than each other. Even so, Spartan that he was, he did his duty and took on the Athenian fleet at the Battle of Arginusae. Athens, at this point, had gotten to the bottom of the barrel. A substantial part of their fleet was boxed under the command of a guy named Conon. They had to use wildly underage, untrained rowers. They had even, which they were most reluctant to do, to free slaves in order to get the naval personnel to man their fleet. They had a crash building program. They were finally able to come up with a fleet which was slightly bigger but vastly less skilled than that of the Spartans and Callicratidas. And amazingly, in 406, in the last battle that they won in the Peloponnesian War, they proved victorious at the Battle of Arginusae. Callicratidas, in full armor, fell overboard and drowned. The Athenians sent off a detachment to try to aid the fleet of Conon, which was besieged by other Spartan warships. In the meantime, a storm blew up, and those Athenians remaining attempted to rescue the survivors, but had to call off operations because of bad weather. The result is hard to believe. Athens, at this point, was way behind the count, holding on by a string. And when the six of the eight Athenian admirals, unwise enough to come home from Arginusae arrived at Athens. They were put on trial for their lives, for failing to rescue the survivors of the battle. Their plea that weather didn't permit it and the rest of the fleet was detached doing its duty, trying to defeat the Spartan fleet absolutely, cut no ice, and they were condemned to death and executed. It is no surprise, therefore, that the following year, Lysander, returning nominally as aide to the Navarch, de facto Navarch himself, was able to defeat the ill-commanded Athenian fleet once and for all in the Hellespont at the Battle of Aegis Potamoi, where he succeeded in catching the Athenian fleet on the beach. The only commander to escape was Conon, who did not bother to come home for some years, not presumably having been encouraged by the welcome which the victors at Arginusae had received. As a footnote to Aegis Potamoi, hard to believe but true, Alcibiades, who had worn out his welcome pretty much everywhere, had retired to a private fortress he had built in the area, and watching the Athenians disposing themselves on the beach with the Spartans across the strait, had taken it upon himself to go to the Athenian commanders and suggest that this was not a very good idea, that they were opening themselves to a surprise attack by Lysander. The commanders told him to get lost and ignored his advice, and very, very shortly, Lysander did exactly what Alcibiades had predicted. The Spartans now had control of the Hellespont over the ensuing months. They starved Athens into submission, sent home every Athenian exile they could find, deliberately to increase the pressure on the food supply, and Athens finally surrendered in 404. Sparta's allies had had more than enough of what they took to be Athenian misbehavior, and it was their wish that Sparta treat Athens as Athens had treated some of its rebelling allies, which is to say, executing all Athenian citizens, which would at this point have included, among others, Plato and Socrates, and selling all the women into slavery. Sparta, though, refused to do that, at least putatively in testimony to the great Athenian contributions in the wars against Persia, and contented herself with reducing the Athenian fleet to a skeleton force, setting up a pro-Spartan oligarchy, and tearing down the long walls. Try as she would, Athens never recovered power to match what she had enjoyed before the beginning of the Peloponnesian War. Sparta was, for the moment, triumphant, but as we'll see in our next lecture, Spartan power, too, certainly Spartan hegemony, proved to be relatively short-lived, and the Spartans, regrettably, proved even less successful than the Athenians had as the dominant polity in an Aegean-wide empire.
This ends Lecture 12.